Or it's always been there.
What?
No.
The JLS CYU tour.
Always. No. You... Okay. Thank you very much. The Freshmen for hosting tonight. So interesting. The last 2 weeks we did, I guess, for lack of a better term, more, I guess, Litvish, dry, you know, not that Ruf Svejic's dry and not that Rufus is dry, but more, you know, straight. Ruf Cook is a very mixed bag. I don't know how many of you know anything about Ruf Cook, but I figure we'll start again with a little bit of like a biography. And he's... Ruf Svejic was slightly controversial because he broke away from his family, from his roots, especially in the area of, let's say, Zionism. But he was still at the core a Rosh Yeshiva. Ruf Cook really is much more, I don't want to use the word renegade, but he is much more involved in matters that really, really, really get him into trouble. Or I don't know if the word trouble, but a lot of people say very negative things about him in a lot of books. More obviously, I think it was called in the Haredi world. Yet the leaders, the real Gedolei Yisrael, always defended him, whereas the minor leaguers, the minor league Gedolim, were the ones who attacked him. And we'll see. I'll give you some examples of that later on. But they have a background. So he's born in 1865 in Griva. In case you don't know where that is, because everyone knows where Griva is, it's Lithuania, Lithuania slash Russia. And the reason, you know, it depends on kind of who's kind of running it at the time, but it says it's Russia, but it's actually more like Lithuania. And he actually dies 70 years later on the third day of Elul in 1935. So it's interesting, he dies, as you'll see. Why the year 1935 is important is because it is right before World War II. Right before World War II. So, you know, it's Elul. If you think Elul, like, you know, August, September, right? When does Hitler really begin? When does Hitler invade Poland?
1937.
So he takes power in 1932, and he invades a few years later in 1949. Right, he invades Poland in September of 1939. Sorry. So it's really Hitler's in power, but he, you know, the laws are just beginning. He's starting to talk, but there's really, and they know nothing with that in Israel. And Ruf Cook's an elderly man at the time, and he knows that. So it's very, and he never sees the founding of the state of Israel. But he definitely is around for, let's say, the first Zionist Congress, right, in 1897. World War I is going to have a tremendous impact on him, as we'll get to in a minute. So in 1888, he takes his first rabbinic position. So how old is he? 30, 23?
Yeah.
Right. At the age of 23. Now that's very young to take a rabbinic position. And he eventually he moves to Israel. How many years later is that? He moves to Israel in 1901. Okay? Moves to Israel right in the beginning of the 20th century. He's in Yafo in 1904. He gets special permission, the rabbis of Yerushalayim, and he becomes a chief rabbi of Yafo and the surrounding areas, but he continues until that summer in 1914. He leaves Israel to be involved in the World Aguda Yisrael. Now, this is the largest rabbinic group that existed, led by the great sages, you know, the Chafetz Chaim, and the great Gedolei Yisrael at the time, were involved in the Agudah, like today, like what's part of the Agudah. And he was part of and seen in that world. And the problem is he gets stuck, because the war breaks out, and he's trapped in Europe, and he can't get back to Israel, and he goes to Switzerland, he goes to England, he serves as a rabbi in England for 3 years, which he learns English, and he studies a little bit more English, and he's also much more familiar, a little bit in his more mature years, of kind of world Jewry and the crisis of world Jewry that's going on in Europe. And then eventually he goes back to Israel in 1916 after the war, and he's the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, and eventually 2 years later in 1921 he's the chief rabbi of Israel until he dies. And just the amazing thing about him is that he learned in the greatest yeshivas of the time. He learns in Ponovich, which is the and Vilna. So there's two centers of Torah life he's part of, and he receives his smicha from, there's a famous sefer called the Aruch HaShocham, which is a very well-known halachic sefer, and he receives smicha from that rabbi, Yechiel Michal Halevi Epstein. So he has tremendous, you know, the greatest of the great rabbis of Israel, of the Jewish people, he learns under, and he is really their students, and he marries into a rabbinic family. His wife is from a descendant of the Aderet, which is actually connected to a little bit more like Chabad, connected to the Tzemach Tzedek. I always get my Lubavitcher Rebbe's mixed up. The third Lubavitcher Rebbe, I don't remember. His wife is married into one of the connections to the Lubavitch world. I'm sorry, I don't remember which one. And in Vilna, he learns under the great Nitziv, who he sees as his real Rebbe himself. Throughout his entire life. So he's, and what's important to understand is that he literally grows up in the greatest rabbinic circles of Europe. And he knows them all, and he rubs shoulders with them all, and those are his teachers, and that's what it is. But he leaves Europe, and he goes to Israel, and he has a transformation. He sees a crisis that's taking place. And he sees that Israel is primarily a secular country, Palestine, right? It's Palestine under the, because he's at least whatever, post, you know, or others, part of the Ottoman Empire, or afterwards under the British Mandate. And he sees thousands of Jews, and by the way, this is also true in Switzerland and England, where he sees thousands of Jews who are alienated from Torah life. And, you know, he looked, you know, I'm sure you've seen pictures of him, he looks like a, you know, classic, you know, Eastern European rabbi. But he was extremely outgoing and sensitive. And so he picked up the rabbinic positions in the rabbinate, not in a yeshiva. Now, usually, you know, what do the big rabbis do? You get a yeshiva that shows you're an important person, right? But he doesn't. And instead, he chooses to be involved in much more communal service, dealing with the masses. When you're chief rabbi of Yafo, you're chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and Israel, you deal mostly in political issues, right? You're dealing with strife between people. You're dealing with community issues, community matters. You're not dealing with great, you know, rabbinical students all day long. He is a prolific speaker. He literally would go speak. And he didn't write a lot, but everyone records what he writes. And so they publish all of his letters. There are, I actually meant to bring a picture of it and I didn't. After high school, I went to yeshiva called Shiloh. Not your most popular high school to go to after. You know, it's where the Mishkan used to be. And they used to, Israelis on their table in yeshiva would have Shas, which is Gemara, and called what's called Shas HaLavan. What is Shas HaLavan? Rav Kook, Sfarim, were published with a white binding and was referred to as Shas HaLavan. So all of his writings, his philosophical writings, his letters and communications, his ideas about the world, about redemption, about the problem, and were all published and interesting. And this was, I think, the broad idea. The yeshiva that he opens up is, of course, called Merkaz HaRav in Yerushalayim. And they open up a publishing house, which is called Mosad Rav Kook. And what's brilliant is that they realize that you need to publish, and you need to write, and you need to get out there. And that's one way. You know, this is before internet. And so one of the ways that so many people become familiar with his writings was because Mosad Rav Kook. Because he wrote a letter that, who's going to see that letter, you know? And dealing with any area of halacha, any area you can think of, especially, and this is really what he's the pioneer, dealing with what's called Torah Eretz Yisrael. Because all of a sudden you have to deal with Shemitah, and you got to deal with non-Jews and Shabbat and milking cows, and who and how are you going to survive? And he begins the idea, kind of the idea, of you got to sell the land of Israel to non-Jews in order to be able to run during Shemitah. Right? How are you going to run during Shemitah? How are you going to not be able to produce things during Shemitah? You're going to go bankrupt. So he allows the Jewish farmers to sell their land to non-Jews. He realizes it's not ideal, but he had no choice. He had no choice. And so these are the areas that he's doing. Most of his halachic matters deal with state issues. Obviously, they deal with personal issues between husband and wife, between families, between... But it's a really... His scope of his writing is extraordinary, and it really, really covers a tremendous amount. It's very broad in what the matters that he deals with. And he combines his deep understanding of Gemara with his love for mysticism. Get a tremendous love for Kabbalah and mysticism, and you're going to see how that plays out, and that affects his worldview. So I want to give you an example of how his understanding of human beings affects how he looks at a secular Jew. Let me give you an example. One of the battles that he had with the great rabbinic world was Zionism. Zionism was seen as a anti-Torah. It was secular. Reviving the land of Israel and with Chilul Shabbat and with literally abandoning, you know, it was almost like Judaism was for Europe. The land of Israel was for Jews to redeem us from the yoke of our grandparents who were backwards and who were followed. That was the message of, in many ways, the Zionist movement. That we're going to become independent and we're going to work the land. And our grandparents never worked the land. They didn't know what land was. And they lived in Europe, but they had potatoes maybe, right? And so they really, they break away from the, you know, we're not going to sell shmatas and peddlers. We're going to get our hands dirty and roll up our sleeves and be strong. And that's what we're going to do. So they had occupations that were different than their families, and they had a different way of life, both in terms of dress and speech. By the way, speaking Hebrew was a rebellion. Jews didn't speak Hebrew, right? You have to remember something, that Hebrew was never a spoken language. Jews always spoke whatever, French, Spanish, German, right? Wherever they lived, they spoke. Hebrew was a language that you davened in, that you learned in. So, but it wasn't what you spoke around a table, right? Up until, you know, 2,000 years ago they did, maybe. So speaking Hebrew was seen as a rebellion against Judaism, as odd as that may seem, right? But that's true. And Rav Kook battled the rabbis of his time, specifically in this area. Because he said, no, you don't understand. Every Jew, deep down inside, has a neshama bo'eret. Right? There's a deep sense of a spiritual religion. But what Rav Kook said was, after hundreds of years of living in exile, this pulsating, you know, yearning of Judaism was covered in what's called klipot. Klipot, it's a Kabbalistic terminology. But it's also translated as... coverings, outer shells. What's over an orange? Peels. Thank you, peels. Sometimes the Hebrew is easier than English, right? Klipot. And these klipot have been mounted over time. And so people who had a religious sense, religious yearning, it shines through, but it manifests itself in very strange ways. So if Cook said, no, you don't understand, their yearning to do all these things is actually because deep down it's a religious, spiritual conviction. They want to rebuild the land of Israel. The land of Israel is a spiritual dimension to it. And so he looks at these people in a very different way. He says, no, these secular Zionists, they might scream and yell and say, we don't care about Torah, we don't care about tradition, we don't care about Judaism, we're going to revitalize the land and break away from the tradition of families and who needs God. And because remember, this is Europe, this is, you know, emancipation and post-emancipation. And Rav Kook said, no, they say something, but really deep down, it's actually quite different. And so Rav Kook looked at these Jews and said, there's something about who they are and what they are that's actually screaming something very spiritual. And so he takes the Kabbalistic idea and he uses it to, I wouldn't even use the word justify, because it's not the right, to explain, to defend, to understand. And so he connects to these men and women, not in a like, all right, I'm trying to help you, no, in a very deep sense. And they felt it, and they knew it. And that's why Rav Kook had tremendous respect from many, many, many of the secular Jews who were in Palestine at the time. They revered him as well, and they saw him almost as their leader. Now, that being said, he was a very, if that were a term, a very frum person. But he had an ability, because of who he was, to connect to so many people. And that was very remarkable, and you have to understand that didn't exist. Like, you can't look at, like, oh, here's your rabbi, you know how to write propaganda, and he gets that. No, rabbis that didn't exist 100 years ago, right? Did not exist. Especially not of Rav Kook's caliber, of the shoulders that he rubbed with, and what he knew, and where he learned, and who learned under him, and who he did not exist. And doesn't surprise you, rabbis in Israel tend to be a little more extreme. And so the rabbinic community of Israel did not appreciate this at all. But they were very stuck. Because how do you deal with this person of this rabbinic stature who learned in the right places, knows everything, yet is doing things that are quote-unquote controversial when they're not that controversial, but they are controversial. The fact they're even willing to sit and have a conversation with these people, you're giving them almost credit. You're giving them a sense of legitimacy, and the rabbinic world of Yerushalayim didn't necessarily see it that way. And people don't realize that. Like, those issues are the exact same issues today in the state of Israel. I don't know if you follow the news, the Israeli government and the Haredim and the army and what's going to happen, right? These things have always been there, not since the state, way before the state. There are many, many issues as well. So what I want to show you, I want to actually bring, I brought three examples of his writing. One is a passage from, right here, called from Arpalei Tohar. I meant to put in a, for every reason, I just have to put it in a box. And every time I put it in a box in Word, it didn't work. Very odd. After 10 minutes, I'm like, it wasn't meant to be. So, let me read you a quote. Let me tell you where I learned this quote from. When I was in grade 10, in Or Chaim, we went to Israel for 8 weeks.
Israel for 8 weeks?
Yeah. So, I had a very large class. There was 10 of us. And on the... From the about the 15th of August until about the 20th of October, we went to Israel. So basically for end of the summer, Chagim. So we didn't miss that much school, if you, you know.
You missed all Chagim, not miss, but like, no,
I mean,
less for all of them?
No, all Chagim, yeah, all Chagim.
So fun.
Yeah, it was amazing. We spent time, now it doesn't exist anymore, we went to a place called BMT, which is kind of turned into Leiv HaTorah. Oh. Did I have the BMT? Right, we were in BMT for a bit. We went to, we lived under Rav Neria in the high school in, oh my goodness, in, what's it called? Kfar Horeh, which is a well-known place. Haroeh, by the way, is from Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, that he founded. And then we also learned a new yeshiva called Or Etzion. And so we bounced around. It was pretty amazing, and it was a different world. You know, there were no cell phones, and there was nothing in those days. I'm not that old, and there's like no, I didn't see my parents at all. And also with 10 people, you could do any tiyul in 3 seconds, right? There's no safety, security. Like, it wasn't like it was the summer of 1990. Like, there's no, I mean, so the Intifada started already in 87, but you know, I don't know, didn't impact us. I don't know. What?
No big deal.
Yeah, it wasn't like, yeah, no, it wasn't a big deal. Yeah, I mean, we went to everywhere. Like, anyways, so again, parents didn't know. You didn't know security. Like, no one knew these things. So, why am I telling you this story? Because we had a madrich whose name was Steve Eli Cohen. I think his name was Steve, and then Eli, so he couldn't call himself Steve. He called himself Eli. I guess, don't ask me why. So he's a guy from England. I have no idea what he's up to now. I remember one thing about him, that he had a glass eye. I don't even know why he had a glass eye. I think he was some injury that he had when he was a kid, not like some war stories, right? Not some like heroic stories, an accident that he had as a kid. And on Yom Kippur, or an Erev Yom Kippur, he gave us a card. He gave us a card. And you know, he wrote a personal message to us. This was our Yom Kippur. So think about Yom Kippur is like, you know, middle of September, end of September. So we're already together 4 or 5 weeks. So, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, day in, day out, you get to know people pretty well. And he wrote a personal card. I have no idea what the card said and all, but the other side had this quote. It was a quote from Rav Kook, from his published in a book called Arpalei Tohar. Arpalei Tohar, this is like a famous song. So if you, Arafel is like a cloud, like a mist, Tohar, of like Tohor. Right, so a cloud of holiness, right? It's a very, Rav Kook spoke in very flowery, you know, over-the-top type of a language. You know, he's like a poet. He wrote tons of poetry, and very poetic, and he was waxing, you know. He spoke in, so his students say, no, it's not poetic. Every word had deep meaning that he intentionally chose based on Kabbalistic understanding. Okay, that's, but for a layman like me, I say it's flowery language. For someone who knows the great depths of Kabbalistic writing, he chose every word intentionally because it has deep secrets to it, which I don't know or understand. But this line was written on the card. And this line, for me personally, almost changed my life view. So I said, if I'm doing Rav Kook, I'm going to start with this line. I even used it in my yearbook when I graduated high school. I modified it a little bit, but that's where I got it from. So I'm going to read it. You tell me what you think it means. If we just do these two lines, you know, Dayenu, maybe not, but we'll see. Okay. Tzadikim haTohorim Inam Koblim Al HaRish'a Ela Mosifim Tzedek. So there's one word which is hard, and that's Koblim. What does the word Koblim mean? I don't expect anybody to know this.
Complain?
Very good. The word Mitlonen. How'd you know that?
I only know it because I know the quote, but not because I know the word.
Very good. Okay. So it means complain. It actually, and this I did not know this. I have a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, who's in JLIC in Brooklyn. He's a big, big, big Talmud of Rav Kook. He reads us. So I called him. So this is, I'm listening to Rav Kook. So I told him I want to use this quote. He goes, oh, you know where that's based on? I said, Arpalei Tohar. He goes, no, it's based on a Mishnah in Yadayim. I'm like, I didn't know that. So, and Ben is not mentioned in the Sefer either. He just studied Rav Kook. So I said, great. So actually comes from Mishnah Yadayim, which the context is actually fascinating, which is actually talking about heretics, talking about things that the rabbis did in order to combat tension between the Jewish heretics. But the word koblim, according to the Rambam in Perashat Mishnayah, he actually says it means not complain. It means anger. Koasim. That's what the Rambam says. Okay, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Complain, getting angry, same idea. Inam koblim. Don't get angry. Don't complain complain, get angry. Al harisha. What does that mean? They don't complain about the risha, which means
like bad.
Bad wickedness. And Allah, what do they do? Mosim tzedek. What do they add?
Righteousness.
They add righteousness. They don't complain, they don't get angry at the heresy, but they add faithfulness. Not faith. Faith and faithfulness are not the same. Right? So have you ever heard the term, this person's a boor, this person's an ignoramus, right? Instead, they add chokhmah. This is a very powerful message because it doesn't look, what do you do? There's a cup that's half empty, or is it half full? So you could complain and you can say, oh, these students or this school, they're this terrible. You could do that in life, but that's not Rav Kook's opinion. Rav Kook says, no. What are you going to benefit from? You know, oh, this program, this is terrible, there are these people. All it does is fester anger in yourself. All it does is get you upset and distraught, and it makes you feel complacent. So the opposite. What do? Turn around. Yeah, there's not enough. You think something's lacking? Don't complain that something's lacking. What do? Find out how to fix it. Don't complain if something is missing. Where's this? Has it? Do it yourself and fill that in. And especially if you understand, now he felt this was true about everything in life. But if you take a look and you look at, for example, at the land of Israel, you could have said, these guys are kafirim, and these guys are secular, and these guys are treif, and these guys are wicked. It's one approach, but his approach wasn't that. His approach was, what do you do instead? You add tzedek. You add righteousness. So people are corrupt, you add your own righteousness. You add your own faithfulness. you add your own wisdom. And she says, that's how you make things better. So that is a very Hasidic, Kabbalistic way. It's a very positive, upbeat look at life. And that was Rav Kook. Many people criticized Rav Kook that he wasn't realistic. Right? That he was, you know, Rav Kook would cry if he'd break a leaf. Because he felt that there is, you know, you break a leaf, you're destroying God's world, and somewhere you're minimizing God, and the angels of the trees are crying, like, and he believed, you know.
Like
he
would, in summer camp, you weren't allowed to pull out grass.
Right, you can't pull out grass.
Why?
You,
you,
because there's a malach on top of each grass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Killing
what was that?
I thought it was, like, just not allowed on
Shabbos. Oh, just not, that's for sure true, right? You're on Disney, you know.
Don't explain it.
Not allowed to pull out grass ever.
There's a story
about, I know, but we don't want to say there's, like, you know. Just can't do it.
So it's an amazing thing. Rav Kook one time was asked to plant a tree. You know, some. So, you know, like. So they gave him, like, a shovel, put the shovel aside, rolled up his sleeves, took off his jacket, rolled up his sleeves, and he planted the tree with his bare hands.
Why?
He said, two reasons why. One, I want my hands to touch the soil of Eretz Yisrael, which has Kedusha to it. And he also said, my hands aren't dirty. My hands are clean if I touch the soil. Don't look at it as if... So that... And he started crying when he did it. Like... And he... Not because... That's... He really felt it and he believed in everything that he did. So... And it really... It says a lot about who he was and how he viewed the world. This Arota Chuvah is super complicated. Okay, let's do it. Okay, let me give you an example of his idea. So, I don't know if you're familiar, there's a famous midrash that says, when the world usher brought, these psukim, when the world is created, the Torah says in Breishit, that, do you have a chumash? Actually, just forget, I actually don't get it. Is it behind me?
Yeah.
It's passive, never mind. The Torah says in Breishit, in Perek Aleph, that when Hashem created the world, he created the world, it's called Etz Oseh Pri Luminei. Etz Pri Oseh Pri Luminei. Where the literally the fruit okay it says Tachar Dasha Ace Mizu Zera eight pre Osapune Hashem said Vimar Lokim this is what should happen there's a eight pre a fruit tree producing fruit of its kind. Now, what happens? Vatasaraz desha, esim azuzera, et puri osepuri. So there's a famous midrash that says, ideally, an etz puri produces a puri. Not an etz produces a puri. Meaning that even the bark of a tree is supposed to taste as sweet as a fruit. You follow? An etz puri produces a puri. As opposed to an etz producing a pri. So there's a famous midrash that said, the earth sinned and didn't listen to God. Rav Kook says, how could the earth sin? There's no b'chirach v'shi. He says, no, you don't understand. In Arota Tshuvah, which is a quote that you have here, he wrote a very famous book called Orot. So a lot of his writings are called Orot. Arota Tshuvah is his... I don't even know how many chapters it is, on repentance. Because for Rav Kook, tshuva is not just about individuals, it's about a national redemption of tshuva, of returning. Part of it includes not just returning to religion, but returning to Eretz Yisrael. And what he says here is the following. Tchilat abriya, re'uri haya, in the beginning of creation, re'uri haya, tama etz liyar gamu tama pri. Then in the beginning of creation, the fruit of a tree supposed to taste like the tree itself. Meaning, you go to an apple tree, you break off the bark, you could eat it, and it's just as juicy as the fruit itself. Okay? Kol ha'emtza'im ha'machzikim ezo megama ruchani gvoha klalit. So, all the middle, all the means that hold machzikim ezo megama, that have a that they're... The goal of a bark, of a branch, is to, we look at it as produce the fruit, right? That's, what's the purpose of a branch? Well, eventually the end of a branch has the fruit. And he says, ideally what should it have been, that it also has a spiritual, an elevated spiritual desire. Ruim hayu liyot muchashim b'chush nishmati b'otag hagbavanam. That he should also have this lofty, elevated, pleasant desire. She'etzem megama morgeshet bo kishe'ino miyatzra ota. That it has this objective, this feeling of objective, even when it's not being created. Aval teva ha'aretz, but the nature of the earth. Ha'tnodedot achayim, the something there's no dead, like the waving of life, the pulsating of life. La'ot ruchanik shehin. Yishai was writing is very exalted, fluffy, right? La'ot ruchanik shehin nizger b'nizger gufanit garam shirak tamo ashal apri. And he says, what happened was, there was a sin, there was an error that happened, but only the fruit is sweet. I don't think anybody here is interested in tasting the bark. It doesn't taste good. That only the end is the ideal. Can you taste the ni'ima, the pleasantry, and the glory of it? But the bark, the trees, that on them the fruit hangs, in kol nichitotam legadol apri, and all that they do to help, they might help the fruit grow. Nit avuv nigashmuv avdu etamam. They have no taste. Zeu chetar. That's the sin of the land. We see from here. I'm going to explain. Rav Kook is taking a well-known midrash. By the way, Rashi quotes that midrash in the parsha, and Rav Kook is trying to find a very deep philosophical human ideal, and he says, "What does this mean?" I'm going to actually say the rest outside. I was practical time, get anything done. And he says the following. He says, look, in life, everyone likes the fruit. Meaning, everyone likes the fruit of their labor. So, let's use a farmer as a good example. I produce a grape. I'll eat it afterwards. Don't worry. I produce a grape. This is the fruit of my labor, both literally and figuratively. Right? Eating this fruit is amazing. But waking up at 6 in the morning, planting and harvesting and reaping and schwitzing and will it not work? That's not fun. Means to something are never enjoyable. The end, the fruit, the, we all know, studying for a test, unless you're sadistic, is not fun. Maybe not even getting your grade isn't fun. Ah, but the job, hopefully that's enjoyable, right? Here's for any example, right? Child rearing. I'm sure none of you understand this at all, but the, you know, bringing up children can be very difficult. But when the bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, when they graduate, when they're married, whatever stage it is in life, parents like all of that difficult work and time and money. Rav Kook says the ideal is that you're supposed to enjoy and get satisfaction as much from the means as from the end. Meaning the, you know, when you let's say you want you're putting on an event or a program, you're preparing and you're calling and you're making work. That's not fun. The program itself, the event itself, is amazing. He says no, you should have as much satisfaction from putting out place cards, from folding napkins, from the actual final event itself. That he says studying for tests and going to class should be as enjoyable as the final product, whatever the final product is. Right? You should get as much. He says, the earth sinned. What does he mean? That the human nature isn't like that anymore. That ideally, we shouldn't just say the fruit is sweet in the goal, but the process needs to be. And he says, that's a tragedy. That's not the way the world was supposed to be. Right? So, which is first of all, look at that midrash. They come up with that idea. It's a very profound, profound message and idea. And he goes on to say that in life, if we were to just realize what's the ideal, we'd be able to deal with certain challenges. And look at them. Again, that's a very idealistic, very positive. You're like, going every morning at 6 a.m. and planting. You know, that's not fun. Where's the enjoyment, right? Sometimes you do these most petty things in the entire world, right? You make a simcha, right? You're making lists and you're checking lists and who's come. It's like, it's numbing. It's mind-numbing. No, it's supposed to be, what do you mean? This is just as enjoyable as, very idealistic, but we see it's Rav Kook's understanding of how he takes these ideals and ideas, finds a pasuk, finds a midrash, finds an idea. And again, he's using those two pasuk, those two lines in Arpalei Tohar, in many ways, have a positive outlook in everything that we do, kind of what encompassed his life. And he says, Netinat ruach l'ruach ha-tzadik. He says, that is what's supposed to give you, he says, look at the last two lines. The ruach ideali lachdor, because it's the ideal spirit. Lachdor betikfa gam bechalkei komach shem harabim. That you're supposed to have this ideal spirit in every stage that you're doing. Mikulam yutam ta'amo shal ziv ha-megamati. That you're supposed to taste. So ziv is referring to ziv ha-shchina. Right? You're supposed to taste from the heavenly spark of everything that you do in life. Lo yisa od adam cherpat atzlut b'derech ha-chema amidu. And you're not supposed to, you know, the mundane shouldn't bother you. Don't be bogged down by these things, but elevate them and look at them as spiritually invigorating and uplifting, as exciting as the purpose itself. Okay? So I think that really shows a lot of Rav Kook's outlook in life. The last piece that I wanted to use was also it's the same thing. I tried to find three things that kind of had his worldview, but also had kind of like the same idea. Comes from, actually, what I'm going to do, I'm actually going to read you quotes before I do this last one, because I want you to appreciate sometimes how controversial he was, or at least how people thought of him. So, Rav Yitzchak Gerchthorn, the founder of Bnei Brak, told this story in 1934. Rav Kook was invited to the groundbreaking ceremony of the Bet Yosef, which was the Navarak Yeshiva of Bnei Brak. So he sees invited, right, to at this ceremony, which the Chazon Ish also attended, Rav Kook spoke at length. Throughout the Rav's address, the large crowd sat quietly in their seats, everybody but the Chazon Ish. He remained standing throughout the speech, listening attentively to every word. He only sat down when the Rav finished speaking and took his own seat. Why? He said, why? They asked him. Rav Tzvi Kagan turned to the Chazon Ish and says, I don't understand. How come you stood during Rav Kook's speech? He said, since the Torah was standing, I thought I had to stand as well. Now, that's an amazing statement, because the Chazon Ish Rav Kook did not agree on many, many matters and issues that pertain to the land of Israel. So, as I always say, the heavyweights, the real Gedolei Yisrael, had tremendous respect for Rav Kook. The students, unfortunately, did not always see it that way. And let me give you an example of it. Rosh Hashanah and Orbach, I'll give you before you, was a student of Rav Kook's. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach wrote a very famous book on halacha called Morei Eish, which was about electricity and how to place electricity. He received approbations, like askamas, from the great leaders of Israel at the time. They were Rav Abba Yaakov Baruchov, Rav Ishtar Zalman Meltzer, Rav Avram Yitzchak Kook. Who did he put first? Rav Kook. Even though Rav Kook was like, you know, not always seen as the greatest, you know, you think you'd want to put, you know, Rav Ishtar Zalman Meltzer, who was the great, you know, rabbinic sage at the time, because he felt a tremendous respect for him. Here, there's a story that they say. Here, there was in. Where's this one story? Where did I put it? The Netziv said that Rav Kook was equal to everybody else in his yeshiva. Oh, here it is. There was a rabbinic conference in Vienna in the year 5683. So that would have been, so today is 50. So that's 109, that's about 90, that's like in 1914. Right around that time. One of the rabbis made a disparaging remarks about Rav Kook. The Chofetz Chaim was sitting at the dais, stood up, shocked, and said, "You insulted the Mar D'Atra of Eretz Yisrael." He left the conference and didn't return. Chavetz Chaim waited in his hotel to return to his city, which was in Radin, New City, and many people came to visit him to receive a bracha. When the members of the delegation from Eretz Yisrael wanted to enter, he said, "I will not say shalom, I will not say hi, to anybody who caused a dispute with Maran HaRav Kook." He said, "Everything Rav Kook does is holy, pure, and anyone who impinges on his honor will not go unpunished." So you see throughout many times that some people, you know, would try and denigrate Rav Kook. And there were the great leaders who always were there to defend him. So interesting, there's many, many, many stories like this. They say there's a story of, who was it? Who just passed away? The story of Rav Eliashiv, who saw a sign in Yerushalayim. Cook. Anyways, remember the story. Again, even in the modern era, you see sometimes people who denigrate Rav Kook. And
like people to the right, you're saying?
People to the right. Yeah, that's what I'm referring to. Yeah, people to the right. And how the great leaders, you know, like who passed away recently, right? Yeshu passed away not long, long ago. Always come. They knew him. They actually knew who he was. Or they knew of his son. His son was Rav. His son took over for him as head of the yeshiva. What was his name escapes me. Okay. When Theodor Herzl passed away in the summer of 5764. So, can I borrow your pen for a second?
Yeah.
What year is that? So now we're in 5778. This is... So Theodor Herzl passes away... 104 years ago. So it's 2000. Was that right?
Yeah, we're 18.
Oh, sorry, six. Right, it's a six. My mistake. 114 years ago. So it's now 2018. So that would be 1903. 1904. There you go. You're right. 1904. Math is way better than mine. Okay, 1904. So if Theodor Herzl passed away in the summer of 1904, Theodor Herzl, as we know, was a controversial figure definitely in the religious world. And Rav Kook decides to give a eulogy about him. He quotes a pasuk from Zechariah that said, "Byom Ehud, a certain day, Yigdal HaMisper B'Yerushalayim, that will grow the eulogy of Jerusalem, K'Misper HaDard Rimon B'Bikat Megadon." Some type of great eulogy that took place in the past. Chazal said, this is referring to Yonatan ben Uziel. He said, this is a comes Rav Yonatan ben Uziel, who wrote a perush on this pasuk, said there'll come a time where there'll be a great earth trembling in the land of Israel. Meaning, Rav Kook took this pasuk to say that maybe what Zechariah was referring to was the passing of Theodor Herzl. Now, people misunderstand it, saying that, oh, Rav Kook thought that Theodor Herzl was like, you know, this. No, what Rav Kook was saying was that Theodor Herzl was a person who literally dedicated his entire life to the Jewish people, even though he was totally secular. He wasn't anti-religious as much as he was just an ignoramus. He just didn't know anything. So, you know, he was a Western European Jew who knew very little. Theodor Herzl is very much inspired from a Jewish perspective, a nationalist perspective, from the famous trial of
Dreyfus.
Of Dreyfus, the Dreyfus trial, right? Teferis Bechago, that's pretty good.
My grandfather was at the Basel conference.
Was he really? Mm-hmm. That's cool, right? So, at the Dreyfus trial, that Herzl was a working for a newspaper. He attended to write for the famous newspaper in France called, I don't remember right now. He was shocked about how anti-Semitic the trial was, and he began to think about, I don't understand. I thought, said Theodor Herzl, and this is very important, Jews of Europe thought, oh, well, how are we going to solve anti-Semitism? By assimilating. The more German, the more French, the more we are, they won't hate us because we're like them. Theodor Herzl in his milieu and thought, okay, it's over. We can vote in these countries. There's emancipation. And that didn't happen. Just if France, which is one of the first countries to allow Jews to vote, still has this terrible diatribe against the Jewish people, clearly this is not working. What is the solution to anti-Semitism? First round, said assimilation. Now it's not. Now it's, we need to get out of Europe, and we need to start our own country. And that's why there's a political Zionism, is a political solution to anti-Semitism. And Herzl's like, oh, where should we go? Oh, let's go to Palestine, because like, Palestine is nothing. It's not like it's like a major, you know, metropolitan area. Let's go there. Okay, it's an issue. Maybe we'll go to Uganda, but, you know. Herzl's idea was, we got to get out. We got to serve them. So Rav Kook says, you don't understand, a person who has that yearning, who wants to solve a Jewish existential crisis, has a deep religious, spiritual desire. They don't realize it. They're not aware of it. It's they're deep in their subconscious. And he spoke about, there's two different Mashiachs. There's a Mashiach Ben David, who's going to spiritually revive the people. And there's Mashiach Ben Yosef, who's going to physically revive the people. That's based on a Pasuk. That's based on, first of all, it's based on a Gemara in Sanhedrin. And also Yosef, what did he do? What did Yosef provide his brothers? Food, after the famine. He physically helped the people. Yehuda, on the other hand, was looked upon as the spiritual leader, especially in the world of Midrash. Yehuda was looked upon and played that role. So he says you need two different types of leaders. You need a spiritual leader, and you need a political leader. And he said, Theodor Herzl, in every generation, we have the potential, or we have figures who take on these roles, and Theodor Herzl was one of these individuals who took on this persona of Mashiach ben Yosef. And Rav Kook, and this the eulogy, was referred to as the great Hamisped Yerushalayim, the great Hesped that Zechariah spoke about, the great eulogy. Rav Kook uses that analogy, uses that as a way to talk about the great things of really of what Theodor Herzl, what he wanted to do. The fact that you can gather all the Jews, the fact you can have a gathering of Jews, you know, in Vienna, right? The Jews gather is like unheard of. So he managed to do all those things, and he met with government officials, and very much Theodor Herzl was a failure, meaning he died sick and aged and decrepit and a pauper. I think he was wealthy at some point. He lost all his money, right? He never saw his fruits of labor come to fruition. And I think, and Rav Kook saw it in someone who gives up their entire being for the sake of the Jewish people, which Rav Kook saw as a very deep religious idea, as something which needs to be thanked. This, by the way, this is like 10% of the entire Hesped. And that's where he says, if you take a look, Chazal amru shehesped zeh hiya Mashiach ben Yosef sheniharag. Chazal understood that this Hesped that Zechariah is referring to is going to be said about, a eulogy about Mashiach ben Yosef who get killed. He says, why do we need two Mashiachs for? You know? Just have one Mashiach. Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. He says, ideally, you need one leader. Right? You need one leader. The person who's able to combine the goof and the neshama. This is another whole understanding of Kook's life, as how Rav Kook looks at Chol and Kodesh, Kodesh and Chol. This is also a major theme in Rav Kook's writing. And he says, that's ideally, you should have only one leader who's able to have you know, what is it like? You know, in Israel today, you have a minister of education, you have a minister of religious affairs, a minister of financial affairs. Ideally, you should have one minister, and they should really be in charge of everything. By the way, it's a function of a king in many ways, right? So, you know, and he says, but that's ideal, but that's not always what's going to happen. And that's why you're going to have two Mashiachs. And so, what? Again, very much, this is Rav Kook's theology. This is Rav Kook's way of life and how he believed it in every ounce and every fiber of his body. They say, I tried to find it. And they say that the Rugachever, who was one of the greatest rabbinic figures who lived also around the same time as Rav Kook, he wouldn't get a haircut because he felt it was he'd waste time learning Torah. He was like one of these brilliant minds. He said that we don't hold like Rav Kook in Olam Hazeh, but the times of Mashiach we're going to hold like Rav Kook. Meaning Rav Kook is not, his feet are not in this ground. He's like in a different stratosphere, right? He's like in this idealistic, you know, world of that people really can't, at least he felt that people, that's not the world that people live in, they're grounded in. And maybe we'll end, and we'll end with this. If you take a look in this Hesped, there's a line, HaKadoshot Yisrael Mitzuyonim Behem. The holiness, the Jewish find themselves in, Liyot Am Kadosh LaHashem L'Kei Yisrael. That we strive to be holy to God, Liyot Goyachad Baretz, to become one nation in the land, Lo'or HaGoyim, light unto the nations, V'atzar HaShini Etzam HaKoach L'Shachlel Ruchanut Be'atzma. And while we're doing all these things to become holy with our God, to become one nation in our land, and really a sign and light unto the nations of the world, at the same time, we also have to combine them all together and to infuse them and diffuse everything that we do with a sense of neshama, of holiness, of what Hashem wants from us. And how perhaps, you know, certain nations of the world emphasize the physicality and people emphasize the physicality. That's, I realize, is part of life. But he said, really, they're emphasizing only their animalistic sense, and a human being consists and is infused with both of these ideas, of both the goof and the neshama. And a person shouldn't look at as it's bifurcated, that it's two dimensions that are necessarily combating each other, that I struggle, although that was, you know, a lot of writings, a lot of, you know, you fight in your physical sense of, no. Rav Kook felt that the physical and spiritual could be totally infused into one. And that was his ideal, and that's how we kind of saw how the world was hopefully heading to be. I'm not sure what Rav Kook would say today about the situation that the Jewish people find themselves in. I think he'd be a little disappointed. I think he thought that things were going to pick up a little bit more. But there's no question that Rav Kook's influence and his students, that's another amazing thing. He has students who... in many ways, you know, Rav Soloveitchik's impact in America, Rav Kook had a tremendous impact in the land of Israel, and influenced hundreds, thousands of yeshivot and books and writings and understandings and both and this positive sense of this idealism and joy and appreciating, hopefully, with the land of Israel, opportunities they will bring, was something which, you know, it's good to be reminded of and putting life into perspective. And trying to really focus on the positive and to connect this language, which is spiritually uplifting. And I think with that positive energy and that positive message, I do believe we are in need of, and I think can have a tremendous impact on perhaps solving various, you know, perhaps there's tension that might exist. And hopefully, the more we appreciate Rav Kook, and again, most of his writings are very difficult to understand, but I think a little bit that we could kind of understand, we have tremendous appreciation for. And hope that it'll continue to inspire us and his leaders and the Am Yisrael for many years to come.
Thank you. Only.